I want to. And the blanks have been filled in with different colors of chalk, smudged and half-melted from the rain and snow in all different handwriting. We walk along reading. Before I die, I want to have kids, live in London, own a pet giraffe, skydive, divide by zero, play the piano, speak French, write a book, travel to a different planet, be a better dad than mine was, feel good about myself, go to New York City, no equality, live. Finch bumps my arm and hands me a piece of blue chalk. I say, there's no space left.
So we make some.
He writes, before I die, I want to, and draws a line. He writes it again. Then he writes it a dozen more times.
After we fill these up, we can keep going on the front of the building and down the other side. It's a good way to figure out just why we're here.
And I know by here, he doesn't mean this sidewalk. He starts writing. Play guitar like Jimmy Page. Come up with a song that will change the world. Find the great manifesto. Count for something. Be the person I meant to be, and have that be enough. Know what it's like to have a best friend. Matter. For a long time, I just stand there reading. And then I write, stop being afraid. Stop thinking too much. Fill the holes left behind. Drive again. Write. Breathe. Finch stands over my shoulder. He is so close I can feel his breath. He leans forward and adds, before I die, I want to know a perfect day. He steps back, reading it over, and steps forward again. And meet Boy Parade. Before I can say anything, he laughs, rubs it out, and replaces it with, and kiss Violet Markey. I wait for him to erase this, too. But he drops the chalk and brushes the dust off his hands, wiping them on his jeans. He gives me a crooked grin, and then he stares at my mouth. I wait for him to make a move. I tell myself, just let him try. And then I think, I hope he does. And the thought alone sets off the electric currents and sends them shooting through me. I wonder if kissing Finch would be that different from kissing Ryan. I've only kissed a handful of boys in my life, and they were pretty much all the same. He shakes his head.
Not here. Not now.
And then he jogs toward the car. I jog after him, and once we're inside and the engine and the music are on, he says,
before you get any ideas, that doesn't mean I like you.
Why do you keep saying that?
Because I see the way you look at me.
Oh, my God. You are unbelievable. He laughs. Back on the road, my mind is racing. Just because I wanted him to kiss me for, like, 1 second doesn't mean I like Theodore Finch. It's just that it's been a while since I've kissed someone who isn't Ryan. In our notebook, I write, before I die, I want to. But that's as far as I get, because all I see is Finch's line floating on the page. And kiss Violet Markey. Before Finch takes me home, he drives straight to the quarry in downtown Bartlett, where they don't even check our IDs. We walk right in, and the place is crowded and smoky, and the band is loud. Everyone seems to know him, but instead of joining the band on stage, he grabs my hand and we dance. 1 minute he acts like he's in a mosh pit, and the next we're doing the tango. I shout over the noise. I don't like you either. But he just laughs again.
Finch. Day 15. Still. On the way back to Violet's house, I think up epitaphs for the people we know. Amanda Monk, I was as shallow as the dry creek bed that branches off the Whitewater River. Romer, my plan was to be the biggest asshole I could be, and I was. Mr. Black, in my next life, I want to rest, avoid children, and be paid well. So far, she's been quiet, but I know she's listening, mostly because there's no one else around but me. What would yours say, Ultraviolet?
I'm not sure.
She tilts her head and gazes out over the dash at some distant point, as if she'll see the answer there.
What about yours?
Her voice sounds kind of drifting and far off, like she's somewhere else. I don't even have to think about it. Theodore Finch, In Search of the Great Manifesto. She gives me a sharp look, and I can see she's present and accounted for again.
I don't know what that means.
It means the urge to be, to count for something, and, if death must come, to die valiantly with acclamation, in short, to remain a memory. She goes quiet, as if she's thinking this over.
So where were you Friday? Why didn't you go to school?
I get these headaches sometimes, no big deal. This isn't an out-and-out lie, because the headaches are a part of it. It's like my brain is firing so fast that it can't keep up with itself. Words, colors, sounds. Sometimes everything else fades into the background, and all I'm left with is sound. I can hear everything, but not just hear it, I can feel it too. But then it can come on all at once. The sounds turn into light, and the light goes too bright, and it's like it's slicing me in two, and then comes the headache. But it's not just a headache I feel. I can see it, like it's made up of a million colors, all of them blinding. When I tried to describe it to Kate once, she said, "You can thank Dad for that. Maybe if he hadn't used your head as a punching bag." But that's not it. I like to think that the colors and sounds and words have nothing to do with him, that they're all me and my own brilliant, complicated, buzzing, humming, soaring, roaring, diving, godlike brain. Violet says, "Are you okay now?" Her hair is windblown and her cheeks are flushed. Whether she likes it or not, she seems happy. I take a good long look at her. I know life well enough to know you can't count on things staying around or standing still, no matter how much you want them to. You can't stop people from dying. You can't stop them from going away. You can't stop yourself from going away either. I know myself well enough to know that no one else can keep you awake or keep you from sleeping. That's all on me, too. But man, I like this girl. Yeah, I say. I think I am. At home, I access voicemail on the landline, the one Kate and I get around to checking when we remember, and there's a message from Embryo. Shit. Shit, shit, shit. He called Friday because I missed our counseling session, and he wants to know where in the hell I am, especially because he seems to have read the Bartlett Dirt, and he knows, or thinks he knows, what I was doing on that ledge. On the bright side, I passed the drug test. I delete the message and tell myself to be early on Monday, just to make it up to him. And then I go up to my room, climb onto a chair, and contemplate the mechanics of hanging. The problem is that I'm too tall, and the ceiling is too low. There's always the basement, but no one ever goes down there, and it could be weeks, maybe even months, before Mom and my sisters would find me. Interesting fact, hanging is the most frequently used method of suicide in the United Kingdom, because, researchers say, it's viewed as being both quick and easy. But the length of the rope has to be calibrated in proportion to the weight of the person.
Otherwise, there is nothing quick or easy about it. Additional interesting fact, the modern method of judicial hanging is termed the long drop. That is exactly what it feels like to go to sleep. It is a long drop from the awake and can happen all at once. Everything just stops. But sometimes there are warnings, sound, of course, and headaches. But I've also learned to look out for things like changes in space, as in the way you see it, the way it feels. School hallways are a challenge, too many people going too many directions, like a crowded intersection. The school gym is worse than that, because you're packed in and everyone is shouting, and you can become trapped. I made the mistake of talking about it once. A few years ago, I asked my then-good friend, Gabe Romero, if he could feel sound and see headaches, if the spaces around him ever grew or shrank, if he ever wondered what would happen if he jumped in front of a car or train or bus, if he thought that would be enough to make it stop. I asked him to try it with me just to see, because I had this feeling, deep down, that I was make-believe, which meant invincible. And he went home and told his parents, and they told my teacher, who told the principal, who told my parents, who said to me, "Is this true, Theodore? Are you telling stories to your friends?" The next day, it was all over school, and I was officially Theodore Freak. 1 year later, I grew out of my clothes because, it turns out, growing 14 inches in a summer is easy. It's growing out of a label that's hard. Which is why it pays to pretend you're just like everyone else, even if you've always known you're different. "It's your own fault," I told myself then. "My fault I can't be normal. My fault I can't be like Romer or Ryan or Charlie or the others. It's your own fault," I tell myself now. While I'm up on the chair, I try to imagine the asleep is coming. When you're infamous and invincible, it's hard to picture being anything but awake. But I make myself concentrate because this is important. It's life or death. Smaller spaces are better, and my room is big. But maybe I can cut it in half by moving my bookcase and dresser. I pick up the rug and start pushing things into place. No one comes up to ask what the hell I'm doing, although I know my mom and Decca and Kate, if she's home, must hear the pulling and scraping across the floor. I wonder what would have to happen for them to come in here. A bomb blast? A nuclear explosion? I try to remember the last time any of them were in my room, and the only thing I can come up with is a time 4 years ago, when I really did have the flu. Even then, Kate was the one who took care of me. Finch. Days 16 and 17. In order to make up for missing Friday, I decide to tell Embryo about Violet. I don't mention her by name, but I've got to say something to someone other than Charlie or Brenda, who don't do more than ask me if I've gotten laid yet, or remind me of the ass-kicking Ryan Cross will give me if I ever make a move on her. First, though, Embryo has to ask me if I've tried to hurt myself. We run through this routine every week, and it goes something like this. Embryo: "Have you tried to hurt yourself since I saw you last?" Me: "No, sir." Embryo: "Have you thought about hurting yourself?" Me: "No, sir." I've learned the hard way that the best thing to do is say nothing about what you're really thinking. If you say nothing, they'll assume you're thinking nothing, only what you let them see. Embryo: "Are you bullshitting me, son?" Me: "Would I bullshit you, an authority figure?" Because he still hasn't acquired a sense of humor, he squints at me and says, "I certainly hope not." Then he decides to break routine.
I know about the article in the Bartlett Dirt.
I actually sit speechless for a few seconds. Finally, I say, "You can't always believe what you read, sir." It comes out snarky. I decide to drop the sarcasm and try again. Maybe it's because he's thrown me, or maybe it's because he's worried, and he means well, and he is one of the few adults in my life who pay attention.
Really?
My voice actually cracks, making it clear to both of us that the stupid article bothers me more than I let on. After this exchange is over, I spend the rest of the time proving to him how much I have to live for. Today is the first day I've brought up Violet.
So there's this girl. Let's call her Lizzie.
Elizabeth Mead is head of the macrame club. She's so nice, I don't think she'd mind if I borrowed her name in the interest of guarding my privacy. She and I have gotten to be kind of friendly, and that's making me very, very happy. Like, stupidly happy. Like, so happy my friends can't stand to be around me happy. He is studying me as if trying to figure out my angle. I go on about Lizzie and how happy we are, and how all I want to do is spend my days being happy about how happy I am, which is actually true. But finally he says,
"Enough, I get it. Is this Lizzie the girl from the paper?"
He makes air quotes around her name.
"The one who saved you from jumping off the ledge?"
"Possibly." I wonder if he'd believe me if I told him it was the other way around.
"Just be careful."
"No, no, no, Embryo," I want to say. "You, of all people, should know better than to say something like this when someone is so happy. Just be careful implies that there's an end to it all. Maybe in an hour, maybe in 3 years, but an end just the same. Would it kill him to be like, 'I'm really glad for you, Theodore. Congratulations on finding someone who makes you feel so good.'"
"You know, you could just say congratulations and stop there."
"Congratulations." But it's too late. He's already put it out there, and now my brain has grabbed on to "just be careful" and won't let go. I try to tell it he might have meant "just be careful when you have sex, use a condom," but instead, because, you know, it's a brain and therefore is a mind of its own, it starts thinking of every way in which Violet Markey might break my heart. I pick at the arm of the chair where someone has sliced it in 3 places. I wonder who and how as I pick, and try to silence my brain by thinking up Embryo's epitaph. When this doesn't work, I make up one for my mother. "I was a wife and am still a mother, although don't ask me where my children are. And my father, the only change I believe in is getting rid of your wife and children and starting over with someone else." Embryo says,
"Let's talk about the SAT. You got a 2280.
He sounds so surprised and impressed, I want to say, "Oh yeah? Screw you, Embryo." The truth is, I test well. I always have. I say, "Congratulations would be appropriate here as well." He charges on ahead as if he hasn't heard me.
"Where are you planning on going to college?"
"I'm not sure yet."
"Don't you think it's time to give some thought to the future?"
I do think about it. Like the fact that I'll see Violet later today.
"I do think about it," I say. "I'm thinking about it right now."
He sighs and closes my file.
"I'll see you Friday. If you need anything, call me."
Because BHS is a giant school with a giant population of students, I don't see Violet as often as you might think. The only class we have together is U.S. Geography. I'm in the basement when she's on the 3rd floor. I'm in the gym when she's all the way across the school in orchestra hall.
I'm in the science wing when she's in Spanish. On Tuesday, I say to hell with it and meet her outside every one of her classes so I can walk her to the next. This sometimes means running from one end of the building to the other, but it's worth every step. My legs are long, so I can cover a lot of ground, even if I have to dodge people left and right, and sometimes leap over their heads. This is easy to do because they move in slow motion, like a herd of zombies or slugs. "Hello, all of you!" I shout as I run. "It's a beautiful day! A perfect day! A day of possibility!" They're so listless, they barely look up to see me. The first time I find Violet, she's walking with her friend, Shelby Paget. The second time, she says, "Finch, again?" It's hard to tell if she's happy to see me, or embarrassed, or a combination. The third time, she says, "Aren't you going to be late?" What's the worst they can do? I grab her hand and drag her bumping along. "Coming through, people! Clear the way!" After seeing her to Russian literature, I jog back down the stairs, and down more stairs, and through the main hall, where I run directly into Principal Wirtz, who wants to know what I think I'm doing out of class, young man, and why I'm running as if the enemy is on my heels. "Just patrolling, sir. You can't be too safe these days. I'm sure you've read about the security breaches over at Rushville and Newcastle. Computer equipment stolen, library books destroyed, money taken from the front office, and all in the light of day, right under their noses." I'm making this up, but it's clear he doesn't know that. "Get to class," he tells me, "and don't let me catch you again. Do I need to remind you you're on probation?" "No, sir." I make a show of walking calmly in the other direction, but when the next bell rings, I take off down the hall and up the stairs like I'm on fire. The first people I see are Amanda, Romer, and Ryan, and I make the mistake of accidentally ramming into Romer, which sends him into Amanda. The contents of her purse go spiraling across the hallway floor, and she starts screaming. Before Ryan and Romer can beat me to a 6-foot-3-inch bloody pulp, I sprint away, putting as much distance between them and me as I can. I'll pay for this later, but right now, I don't care. This time, Violet is waiting. As I double over, catching my breath, she says, "Why are you doing this?" And I can tell she isn't happy or embarrassed. She's pissed. "Let's run, so you're not late to class." "I'm not running anywhere." "I can't help you, then." "Oh my God, you are driving me crazy, Finch." I lean in, and she backs up into a locker. Her eyes are darting everywhere like she's terrified someone might see Violet Markey and Theodore Finch together. God forbid Ryan Cross walks by and gets the wrong idea. I wonder what she'd say to him. "It's not what it looks like. Theodore Freak is harassing me. He won't leave me alone." Glad I can return the favor. Now I'm pissed. I rest one hand against the locker behind her. "You know, you're a lot friendlier when we're by ourselves and no one's around to see us together. Maybe if you didn't run through the halls and shout at everyone. I can't tell if you do all this because it's expected or because it's just the way you are." "What do you think?" My mouth is an inch from hers, and I wait for her to slap me or push me away. But then she closes her eyes, and that's when I know I'm in. "Okay," I think. "Interesting turn of events." But before I can make a move, someone yanks me by the collar and jerks me back. Mr. Kappel, baseball coach, says, "Get to class, Finch. You too." He nods at Violet. "And that's detention for the both of you."
After school, she walks into Mr. Stoller's room and doesn't even look at me. Mr. Stoller says, "I guess there really is a first time for everything. We're honored to have your company, Miss Markey. To what do we owe the pleasure?" "To him," she says, nodding in my direction. She takes a seat at the front of the room, as far away from me as she can get.
Violet, 142 days to go. 2 a.m., Wednesday, my bedroom. I wake up to the sound of rocks at my window. At first I think I'm dreaming, but then I hear it again. I get up and peek through the blinds, and Theodore Finch is standing in my front yard, dressed in pajama bottoms and a dark hoodie. I open the window and lean out. "Go away!" I'm still mad at him for getting me detention, first of my life. And I'm mad at Ryan for thinking we're going out again. And whose fault is that? I've been acting like a tease, kissing him on his dimple, kissing him at the drive-in. I'm mad at everyone. Mostly myself. "Go away," I say again.
"Please don't make me climb this tree, because I'll probably fall and break my neck, and we have too much to do for me to be hospitalized."
"We don't have anything else to do. We've already done it." But I smooth my hair and roll on some lip gloss and pull on a bathrobe. If I don't go down, who knows what might happen. By the time I get outside, Finch is sitting on the front porch, leaning back against the railing.
"I thought you'd never come," he says.
I sit down beside him, and the step is cold through my layers. "Why are you here?"
"Were you awake?"
"No."
"Sorry, but now that you are, let's go."
"I'm not going anywhere." He stands and starts walking to the car. He turns and says too loudly, "Come on." "I can't just take off when I want to."
"You're not still mad, are you?"
"Actually, yes. But look at me. I'm not even dressed."
"Fine. Leave the ugly bathrobe. Get some shoes and a jacket. Do not take time to change anything else. Write a note to your parents so they won't worry if they wake up and find you gone. I'll give you 3 minutes before I come up after you."
We drive toward Bartlett's downtown. The blocks are bricked off into what we call the boardwalk. Ever since the new mall opened, there's been no reason to come here except for the bakery, which has the best cupcakes for miles. The businesses here are hangers-on, relics from about 20 years ago. A sad and very old department store, a shoe store that smells like mothballs, a toy store, a candy shop, an ice cream parlor. Finch parks the Saturn and says,
"We're here."
All the storefronts are dark, of course, and there is no one out. It's easy to pretend that Finch and I are the only two people in the world. He says,
"I do my best thinking at night when everyone else is sleeping. No interruptions, no noise. I like the feeling of being awake when no one else is."
I wonder if he sleeps at all. I catch sight of us in the window of the bakery, and we look like two homeless kids. Where are we going?
"You'll see."
The air is crisp and clean and quiet. In the distance, the Purina Tower, our tallest building, is lit up, and beyond it, the bell tower of the high school. Outside bookmarks, Finch pulls out a set of keys and unlocks the door.
"My mother works here when she's not selling houses."
The bookstore is narrow and dark. A wall of magazines on one side, shelves of books, a table and chairs, an empty counter where coffee and sweet things are sold during working hours. He stoops behind the counter now and opens a refrigerator that's hidden behind it. He digs around until he comes up with 2 sodas and 2 muffins, and then we move over to the kids' area, which has bean bags and a worn blue rug. He lights a candle he found near the register, and the light flickers across his face as he carries it from shelf to shelf and trails his fingers along the spines of the books. Are you looking for something?
Yes.
Finally, he sinks down beside me and runs his hands through his hair, making it go off in all directions.
They didn't have it at the bookmobile park, and they don't have it here.
He picks up a stack of children's books and hands me a couple.
They do, thank goodness, have these.
He sits cross-legged, wild hair bent over one of the books, and immediately it's as if he's gone away and is somewhere else. I say, I'm still mad at you about getting me detention. I expect some fast reply, something flirty and flip, but instead he doesn't look up. Just reaches for my hand and keeps reading. I can feel the apology in his fingers, and this takes the wind out of me, so I lean into him, just a little, and read over his shoulder. His hand is warm, and I don't want to stop holding it. We eat one-handed and read our way through the stack, and then we start reading aloud from Dr. Seuss, "Oh, the places you'll go." We alternate stanzas. First Finch, then me. Finch, then me. At some point, Finch gets to his feet and starts acting it out. He doesn't need the book because he knows the words by heart. And I forget to read because it's more fun watching him, even when the words and his voice turn serious as he recites lines about dark places and useless places and waiting places where people don't do anything but wait. Then his voice turns light again, and he is singing the words. He pulls me to my feet. The two of us are doing our own version of flip-flapping, which is a kind of leaping over things, the beanbags, the rug, the other books. We sing the last lines together, and end in a heap on the floor, candlelight dancing across us, laughing like we've lost our minds. The only way up the Purina Tower is the steel ladder built into the side, and there seem to be about 25,000 steps. At the top we stand, wheezing like Mr. Black, beside the Christmas tree, which sits planted all year. Up close it's larger than it looks from the ground. Past it there's a wedge of open space, and Finch spreads out the blanket and then we huddle on top of it, arm to arm, pulling the rest of the cover around us. He says,
"Look."
On all sides of us, spread out below, are little white lights and black pockets of trees. Stars in the sky, stars on the ground. It's hard to tell where the sky ends and the earth begins. I hate to admit it, but it's beautiful. I feel the need to say something grand and poetic, but the only thing I come up with is, it's lovely.
Lovely is a lovely word that should be used more often.
He reaches down to cover my foot, which has found its way out of the blanket.
It's like it's ours,
he says. And at first I think he means the word, but then I know he means the town. And then I think, yes, that's it. Theodore Finch always knows what to say better than I do. He should be the writer. Not me. I feel jealous, just for a second, of his brain. And this moment, mine feels so ordinary.
The problem with people is they forget that most of the time it's the small things that count. Everyone's so busy waiting in the waiting place. If we stopped to remember that there's such a thing as a Purina Tower and a view like this, we'd all be happier.
For some reason, I say, I like writing, but I like a lot of things. Maybe out of those things, I'm best at writing. Maybe it's what I like best of all, Maybe it's where I've always felt most at home. Or maybe the writing part of me is over. Maybe there's something else I'm supposed to do instead. I don't know.
There's a built-in ending to everything in the world, right? I mean, 100-watt light bulb is designed to last 750 hours. The sun will die in about 5 billion years. We all have a shelf life. Most cats can live to be 15, maybe longer. Most dogs make it to 12. The average American is designed to last 28,000 days after birth, which means there's a specific year, day, and time to the minute when our lives will end. Your sisters happen to be 18. But if a human was to avoid all life-threatening diseases and infections and accidents, he or she should live to be 115.
So you're saying I may have reached my built-in ending to writing?
I'm saying you have time to decide.
He hands me our official wandering notebook and a pen.
For now, why not write things down where no one will see it? Write it on a piece of paper and stick it on the wall. Of course, for all I know, you may suck at it.
He laughs as he dodges away from me, and then he pulls out an offering. The bookmarks napkins, the half-burned candle, a matchbook, and a lopsided macrame bookmark. We lock them into a flat Tupperware container he's confiscated from his house and leave it sitting out in plain view for the next person who comes here. Then he's up and standing at the edge, where only a knee-high metal guardrail keeps him from falling to the ground. He throws his arms out over his head, fists clenched, and shouts,
"Open your eyes and look at me! I'm right bloody here!"
He shouts all the things he hates and wants to change until his voice is hoarse. Then he nods over at me.
"Your turn."
I join him at the edge, but he's farther out than I am, as if he doesn't care whether he falls off. I take hold of his shirt without him noticing, as if that will save him. And instead of looking down, I look out and up. I think of all the things I want to shout. I hate this town. I hate winter. Why did you die? This last thought is directed at Eleanor. Why did you leave me? Why did you do this to me? But instead I stand there holding on to Finch's shirt, and he looks down at me and shakes his head, and in a moment he starts singing Dr. Seuss again. This time I join him, and our voices drift together across the sleeping town. When he drives me home, I want him to kiss me goodnight, but he doesn't. Instead he strolls backward to the street, hands shoved in pockets, eyes on me.
"Actually, Ultraviolet, I'm pretty sure you don't suck at writing."
He says it loud enough for the entire neighborhood to hear.
Finch. Day 22, and I'm still here. The minute we walk into my dad's house, I know something's wrong. Rose Marie greets us and invites us into the living room, where Josh Raymond sits on the floor playing with a battery-operated helicopter that flies and makes noise. Kate, Decca, and I all stare, and I know they're thinking what I'm thinking. Toys with batteries are too loud. Growing up, we weren't allowed to have anything that talked or flew or made a sound. "Where's Dad?" Kate asks. Looking through the back door, I can see the grill sitting closed. "He came home from the trip, didn't he?"
"He got back Friday. He's just in the basement."
Rose Marie is busy handing us sodas to drink straight out of the can, which is another sure sign that something's wrong. "I'll go," I tell Kate. If he's in the basement, it can only mean one thing. He's in one of his moods, as Mom calls them.
Don't mind your father, Theodore. He's just in one of his moods. Give him time to settle down and he'll be fine.
The basement is actually nice and carpeted and painted, with lights everywhere, and my dad's old hockey trophies and framed jersey and bookshelves packed with books, even though he absolutely does not read. Along one entire wall is a giant flat screen, and my dad is planted in front of this now, enormous feet on the coffee table, watching some sort of game and shouting at the television. His face is purple, and the veins in his neck are hulking out. He's got a beer in one hand, and a remote in the other. I walk over to him, so I'm in his line of sight. I stand there, hands in pockets, and stare at him until he looks up.
"Christ," he says. "Don't go sneaking up on people."
I'm not. Unless you've gone deaf in your old age, you had to hear me coming down those stairs. Dinner's ready.
I'll be up in a while.
I move over so that I'm in front of the flat screen. You should come up now. Your family's here. Remember us? The originals? We're here and we're hungry, and we didn't come all this way to hang out with your new wife and child. I can count on one hand the times I've talked to my father like this, but maybe it's the magic of Badass Finch, because I'm not one bit afraid of him. He slams the beer so hard against the coffee table that the bottle shatters.
"Don't you come into my house and tell me what to do!"
And then he's off the couch and lunging for me, and he catches me by the arm and wham! Slams me into the wall. I hear the crack as my skull makes contact, and for a minute, the room spins. But then, it rights itself, and I say, "I have you to thank for the fact that my skull is pretty tough now." Before he can grab me again, I'm up the stairs. I'm already at the dinner table by the time he gets there, and the sight of his shiny new family makes him remember himself. He says,
"Something smells good,"
gives Rose Marie a kiss on the cheek, and sits down across from me, unfolding his napkin. He doesn't look at me or speak to me the rest of the time we're there. In the car afterward, Kate says, "You're stupid, you know that? He could have put you in the hospital."
"Let him,"
I say. At home, Mom looks up from her desk, where she is attempting to go over ledgers and bank statements. "How was dinner?" Before anyone else can answer, I give her a hug and a kiss on the cheek, which, since we're not a family that likes to show affection, leaves her looking alarmed. "I'm going out." "Be safe, Theodore."
"I love you too, Mom."
This throws her even more, and before she can start crying, I am out the door to the garage, climbing into Little Bastard. I feel better once the engine has started. I hold up my hands, and they're shaking, because my hands, like the rest of me, would like to kill my father. Ever since I was 10, and he sent Mom to the hospital with a busted chin, and then a year later when it was my turn. With the garage door still closed, I sit, hands on the wheel, thinking how easy it would be to just keep sitting here. I close my eyes. I lean back. I rest my hands on my lap. I don't feel much, except maybe a little sleepy, but that could just be me and the dark, slow-churning vortex that's always there, in me and around me, to some degree. The rate of car exhaust suicides in the States has declined since the mid-60s, when emission controls were introduced. In England, where emission controls barely exist, that rate has doubled. I am very calm, as if I'm in science class conducting an experiment. The rumble of the engine is a kind of lullaby. I force my mind to go blank, like I do on the rare occasions I try to sleep. Instead of thinking, I picture a body of water, and me on my back floating, still and peaceful, no movement except my heart beating in my chest. When they find me, I'll just look like I'm sleeping. In 2013, a man in Pennsylvania committed suicide via carbon monoxide, but when his family tried to rescue him, they were overcome by the fumes, and every single one of them died before rescue crews could save them. I think of my mom, and Decca, and Kate. And then I hit the opener, and up goes the door, and out I go into the wild blue yonder. For the first mile or so, I feel high and excited, like I just ran into a burning building and saved lives, like I'm some sort of hero. But then a voice in me says, "You're no hero. You're a coward. You only saved them from yourself." When things got bad a couple months ago, I drove to French Lick, which sounds a hell of a lot sexier than it is. The original name was Salt Spring, and it's famous for its casino, fancy spa and resort, basketball player Larry Bird, and healing springs. In November, I went to French Lick and drank the water, and waited for it to fix the dark, slow churning of my mind, and for a few hours, I actually felt better. But that might have been because I was so hydrated. I spent the night in Little Bastard, and when I woke the next morning, dull and dead feeling, I found one of the guys who worked there and said to him, "Maybe I drank the wrong water." He looked over his right shoulder, then his left, like someone in a movie, and then he leaned in and said, "Where you want to go is Mudlavia." At first, I thought he was high. I mean, Mudlavia? But then he said, "That up there's the real deal. Al Capone and the Dillinger gang always went there after some sort of heist. Nothing much left of it now except ruins. It burned down in 1920, but them waters flow strong as ever. Whenever I get an ache in my joints, that's where I go." I didn't go then, because by the time I returned from French Lick, I was tapped out, and that was it. And there was no more traveling anywhere for a long while. But Mudlavia is where I'm headed now. Since this is serious personal business and not a wandering, I don't bring Violet. It takes about 2.5 hours to get to Cramer, Indiana, population 30. The terrain is prettier here than in Bartlett. Hills and valleys and miles of trees, everything snow-covered, like something out of Norman Rockwell. For the actual resort, I'm picturing a place along the lines of Middle Earth, but what I find is acres of thin brown trees and ruins. It's all crumbling buildings and graffiti-covered walls overgrown with weeds and ivy. Even in winter, you can tell nature is on a mission to take it back. I pick my way through what used to be the hotel, the kitchen, hallways, guest rooms. The place is grim and creepy, and it leaves me sad. The walls still standing are tagged with paint. "Protect the penis. Insanity, please. Fuck all you who may see this." This does not feel like a healing place. Back outside, I tramp through leaves and dirt and snow to find the springs. I'm not sure exactly where they are, and it takes standing still and listening before I go in the right direction. I prepare to be disappointed. Instead, I break through the trees to find myself on the banks of a rushing stream. The water is alive and not frozen over, the trees here fuller than the others, as if the water is feeding them. I follow the creek bed until the embankment grows into rock walls, and then I wade right into the middle, feeling the water push past my ankles. I crouch down and form a cup with my palms. I drink. It's cold and fresh and tastes faintly of mud. When it doesn't kill me, I drink again. I fill the water bottle I brought with me, and then wedge it into the muddy bottom so it doesn't float away. I lie down flat on my back in the middle of the stream and let the water cover me. As I walk into the house, Kate is on her way out, already lighting a cigarette. As direct as Kate is, she doesn't want either of my parents to know she smokes. Usually she waits till she's safely in her car and down the street. She says, "Were you with that girl of yours?" "How do you know there's a girl?" "I can read the signs. Name?"
"Violet Markey."
"The sister?"
"Yeah."
"Do we get to meet her?"
"Probably not."
"Smart."
She takes a long drag on the cigarette.
"Decca's upset. Sometimes I think this Josh Raymond situation is hardest on her since they're practically the same age."
She blows three perfect smoke rings.
"Do you ever wonder..."
"Wonder what?"
"If he's Dad's?"
"Yeah, except he's so small."
"You were small till 9th grade, and look at you now, Beanstalk."
Kate heads down the walk, and I head in, and as I'm shutting the door, she calls,
"Hey, Theo!"
I turn, and she's standing beside her car, nothing but an outline against the night.
"Just be careful with that heart of yours."
Once again, just be careful. Upstairs, I brave Decca's chamber of horrors to make sure she's okay. Her room is enormous and covered with her clothes and books and all the strange things she collects, lizards and beetles and flowers and bottle caps and stacks of candy wrappers and American Girl dolls left over from when she was 6 and went through a phase. All the dolls have stitches on their chins, like the ones Decca got at the hospital after a playground accident. Her artwork covers every inch of wall space, along with a single poster of Boy Parade. I find her on her floor, cutting words out of books she's collected from around the house, including some of Mom's romance novels. I ask if she has another pair of scissors, and without looking up, she points at her desk. There are about 18 pairs of scissors there, ones that have gone missing over the years from the drawer in the kitchen. I choose a pair with purple handles and sit down opposite her, our knees bumping.
"Tell me the rules."
She hands me a book, His Dark Forbidden Love, and says,
"Take out the mean parts and the bad words."
We do this for half an hour or so, not talking, just cutting, and then I start giving her a big brother pep talk about how life will get better, and it isn't only hard times and hard people, that there are bright spots too.
"Less talking," she says.
We work away silently until I ask, "What about things that aren't categorically mean but just unpleasant?" She stops cutting long enough to deliberate. She sucks in a stray chunk of hair, and then blows it out.
"Unpleasant works, too."
I focus on the words. Here's one, and another. Here's a sentence. Here's a paragraph. Here's an entire page. Soon I have a pile of mean words and unpleasantness beside my shoe. Deck grabs them and adds them to her own pile. When she's finished with a book, she tosses it aside, and it's then I get it. It's the mean parts she wants. She is collecting all the unhappy, mad,
bad, unpleasant words and keeping them for herself.
Why are we doing this, Deck?
Because they shouldn't be in there mixed with the good. They like to trick you. And somehow, I know what she means. I think of the Bartlett dirt and all its mean words, not just about me, but about every student who's strange or different. Better to keep the unhappy, mad, bad, unpleasant words separate, where you can watch them and make sure they don't surprise you when you're not expecting them. When we're done, and she goes off in search of other books, I pick up the discarded ones and hunt through the pages until I find the words I'm looking for. I leave them on her pillow. Make it lovely. Then I take the unwanted, cut-up books with me down the hall, where something is different about my room. I stand in the doorway trying to figure out exactly what it is. The red walls are there. The black bedspread, dresser, desk, and chair are in place. The bookshelf may be too full. I study the room from where I stand because I don't want to go inside until I know what's wrong. My guitars are where I left them. The windows are bare because I don't like curtains. The room looks like it did earlier today, but it feels different, as if someone has been in here and moved things around. I cross the floor slowly, as if that same someone might jump out, and open the door to my closet, half expecting it to lead into the real version of my room, the right one. Everything is fine. You are fine. I walk into the bathroom and strip off my clothes and step under the hot, hot water, standing there until my skin turns red and the water heater gives out. I wrap myself in a towel and write, "Just be careful," across the fogged-up mirror. I walk back into the room to give it another look from another angle. The room is just as I left it. And I think maybe it isn't the room that's different. Maybe it's me. In the bathroom again, I hang up my towel, throw on a t-shirt and boxers, and catch sight of myself in the mirror over the sink as the steam starts to clear and the writing fades away, leaving an oval just large enough for two blue eyes, wet black hair, white skin. I lean in and look at myself, and it's not my face, but someone else's. On my bed, I sit down and flip through the cut-up books one by one, reading all the cut-up passages. They are happy and sweet, funny and warm. I want to be surrounded by them, and so I clip out some of the best lines and the very best words, like symphony, limitless, gold, morning, and stick them on the wall, where they overlap with others, a combination of colors and shapes and moods. I pull the comforter up around me as tight as I can, so that I can't even see the room anymore, and lie back on my bed like a mummy. It's a way to keep in the warmth and the light, so that it can't get out again. I reach one hand through the opening and pick up another book, and then another. What if life could be this way? Only the happy parts. None of the terrible, not even the mildly unpleasant. What if we could just cut out the bad and keep the good? This is what I want to do with Violet. Give her only the good. Keep away the bad. So that good is all we ever have around us.
Violet, 138 days to go. Sunday night, my bedroom. I flip through our notebook, Finch's and mine. I pick up the pen he gave me and find a blank page. Bookmarks and the Purina Tower aren't official wanderings, But this doesn't mean they shouldn't be remembered, too. Stars in the sky, stars on the ground. It's hard to tell where the sky ends and the earth begins.